Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stash Ziolkowski.
And today is Monday, June 12th. Our theme today is Stories My Father Told Me.
Okay.
Looking forward to hearing your story, Stash.
Well, yeah, I got a couple of them. My dad told me a lot of things. My dad told me in very short, almost like pronouncements, but he always wound it around sort of like a story. And he told me, he did tell me stuff. But, I think you've heard a couple of things that my father told me, so, but I'm going to repeat them anyway.
I want to thank Andy Moffat Irwin for opening our show this morning. And I want to make sure everybody knows that Andy Offutt Irwin will be in Hagerstown at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Hagerstown and Stories in the Round, our usual monthly venue, on June 26th. That's a Monday at 7 p.m. And I know you will be there, Stash.
You bet.
A lot of other people. So,
yeah. Are you getting a good response?
Yeah, great response. And if our listeners are interested, they need to call me at 301-730-1638 or email me at Fanitsky, F-A-N-I-T-S-K-Y, at hotmail.com. And let me know you're coming, because I think we may very well run out of seats. So getting your tickets.
What are you going to do then?
Is a good idea. I have to lock the doors.
Oh my goodness.
The fire marshal tells us, you know, what the limit is. I haven't looked recently, but it's less than it used to be. So I think people should get their tickets quick.
Okay, wow.
Tell us about Speak.
Well, Speak's coming up tomorrow, in fact. Reverend Robert Jones, June 13th, 7:30. At the Shepherdstown
Opera House.
Opera House. Thank you. I got stuck there for a second. At the Shepherdstown Opera House. And also, it'll be at 7:30 at the Shepherdstown Opera House on Tuesday and on Wednesday. And the Tuesday show will also be on Zoom. So if you want to get details on this, find out all about Reverend Robert Jones, you could look on our website, speakstoryseries.com, and you can get information. You could even sign up to get a season ticket, or you could donate some money if you'd like and become a sponsor, or just read about Reverend Robert Jones. He's an inspirational storyteller, singer, instrumentalist, and visual artist celebrating the history of American roots music. And
I've heard
next month
he's good.
Yeah. Oh, you did hear him.
Yeah.
Jones. I don't think I've ever heard him. I don't know if I have. He hasn't been at Stories Around, has he?
No. But he's been at Jonesboro. I heard him.
Yeah. That. Okay. Well, I haven't been at Jonesboro as many times as you probably. So
that's not true.
Well, I've been there a dozen times.
Yeah, I haven't been there a dozen times.
Oh, okay. So, but I don't ever remember hearing him. And I think I would remember. So I just missed, you know, that 12 times was over a long period of time. So I could have easily missed him. But in July, what's coming up is one of my favorite storytellers, Adam Booth, July 11th and 12th. I'm looking forward to that, because each year when Adam performs in the series, he always does a really outstanding job. And I look forward to it. because I like the way he tells stories.
Great series.
Yes.
Unparalleled and, tellers.
Yep. Oh, that's nice. I like it. Unparalleled.
So do you want to go first with a story? Do you have multiple stories? What you got?
I have a number of, what did I call them? What my dad said, those, you know, he would just like tell me stuff. Pronouncements, right. Hey, one of these days, I'm gonna be on a radio show with you, and they're going to say, well, I guess I'll just speak for Stasha Day because he seems to be out of words.
Yeah, as if that's ever going to happen.
Or at least out of words that he remembers. Okay, so here we go.
Okay.
I have a really great memory of talking to my dad and another kid's father, who was a good friend of my dad. And we didn't get to do many things with our dads who worked. When I was a kid, you know, my dad worked every day. Sometimes he worked 6 days a week. So, you know, sometimes he was called out for on emergencies because he was a troubleshooter on gas lines. He put in gas lines in the streets, and he fixed them if they were leaking. And he was called out, especially sometimes on gas leaks, and twice during his time working for the Baltimore Gas Electric Company, he was involved in working on the gas leak when there was a fire in one, and another time there was an explosion of gas, and he was injured seriously in that explosion. I was pretty young when that happened, and it was a scary thing. I didn't get to talk to my dad for a number of days, because when he came home from the hospital, he was swathed in bandages. I think I might be exaggerating because of being a child when I first saw him, but looked like the mummy. I'd seen it in the movies. His face had gotten not seriously burned, but kind of some kind of a flash burn. And so he had to have gauze on his face and covering it and stuff. Anyway, he and Mr. Bob happened to be talking to Mr. Bob, who lived around the corner, and his son and I were talking to him and to my dad, and they just happened to be standing in front of our house. Mr. Bob had stopped by to say something to my dad, make arrangements at a meeting, something, and we were playing with a ball, and the idea came from Bob. Bobby said, hey, How come you guys don't ever take us out to the park and, you know, play catch with us out there or stuff like that, you know? And I remember both of our fathers kind of looked surprised and said, you know, we work every day. And Bobby became a lawyer, actually, you know, in medical malpractice, and also he was a lawyer for some people got in trouble with the law. Anyway, so he was very precocious as a young child. He said, but yeah, you don't work on Sundays and you don't work on most Saturdays, to his father. And both dads just kind of looked at us puzzled and said, And then my dad said, well, to Mr. Bob said, well, Bob, how about this coming Saturday? Maybe we'll take the boys up to the park and play some ball. And so it was said that we would do that. And they did. They took us up there. It was a one-time thing. And I don't know why it was only once. It was maybe because we were not worth the trouble, but I don't think it was that, because they were two great dads. Anyway, what I remember about that day was they were hitting the balls to us, first on the ground, And Bob and I were on this little grassy area, and they would hit a ball, and they would hit it not right at us, but to the side of us, one way or the other, to get us moving and pick up ground balls. And then they hit us some pop-ups. And one thing that I remember Mr. Bob saying to my father, Paul, he said, "Paul, I think we ought to hit them some high flies." Because when I've watched any kids playing baseball, that's the kind of ball they have trouble tracking and catching. And so I can't remember our exact age, but I think Bobby and I both thought, "Well, we can catch fly ball, you know." But what happened was they both could hit a fly ball that was really high, not so much far, but high. And I think, you know, they would have us take turns. They would, you know, call out, "Okay, Stosh, you're first. Hit the ball." And it would, and I think it took me four tries before I caught one of them. Four times that they hit a ball to me, four times in a row after my turn, then it was the other guy's turn. And each of those four, I missed all of them. It was terrible trying to figure out where they were coming down, because I was not used to having a ball that high above my head. And the same thing happened with my buddy. In fact, one of the balls hit him on the shoulder. He was moving around, and he had his glove in the wrong place, and it bumped on the shoulder. He didn't get hurt, but they were really good. They didn't laugh or anything. Although, when I asked my father a couple years later about that day, he said it was really hard for him and Mr. Bob to watch us, because we looked like a couple of puppies who didn't have enough sense to catch the ball, didn't know how to do it and everything, you know. And but we got better, because they spent a long time there. Each one of us must have had 20 attempts at that. And by the end of what we were doing, we were both doing it okay, because they were giving us advice and telling us about how to do this and that. And being kids, I can remember a conversation Bobby and I had. The other kid, was his name was Bobby, had afterwards, and we did discuss that we hadn't thought our fathers really knew how to play baseball, because they were old, and they weren't really old, of course. They were just mature men. And turns out that because of that conversation with Bobby, I talked to my dad about it and told him that we had trouble with that day. And this was a number of years later, maybe 5 years later or something, and told him that we had figured out you guys probably didn't even play baseball, because in the old days, maybe they didn't even have baseball. And that shows how young we were. We didn't know anything about the history of baseball and stuff. We just knew about pickup games in the park and stuff. And that's when my father had played semi-pro baseball as a 13-year-old on a men's team in a men's league. And he was a catcher. And my dad was a big man, 270 pounds, like a barrel-like chest. And he went to the closet, hall closet, and got out his old catcher's mitt, handed it to me. And I was impressed about how big it was and how heavy it was. It wasn't like a modern catcher's mitt, because my dad had played back in the early part of the century and into the 20s. Anyway, it was a good lesson. And we heard stories while they were hitting the balls to us. Mr. Bob and Paul, my dad, were talking about hitting the ball, and they were swapping stories between them that we didn't even pay attention to. And we should have, because they were talking about when they played, but we were so busy trying to catch a ball. I think I was probably 8 when this happened, 8 or 9. because I didn't even have my own baseball glove then. I didn't get my own baseball glove until I was almost 10 years old, something like that, from Joe Misek, bartender that my dad worked part time for in the evenings. And anyway, the confidence that we got because our dads took the time to spend some time with us on a Saturday, and didn't rush us and didn't try to make it, you know, just okay, that's enough and let's go. I remember talking to Bobby about it a number of times. We both really were pleased because at the time we honestly thought we could say, and maybe it was true, maybe not, but we thought we could say we were the only two guys in the Dorham Street gang that had a chance to play ball with their fathers. So,
and wow. That's it. Great story.
Yeah. It's interesting when you're a kid, you don't stop and think. I think nowadays it might be better because it seems like with all the TV shows and everything and all the chances for kids to get involved in games and, you know, Little League and stuff like that. When I was young, Little League was a big deal, but I was never allowed to play Little League. I'm not sure why. My mother never let me, you know. And mom ran our house pretty good. Dad was always working and mom, stay at home mom, and she kept a tight rein on me. So, nowadays I do see, of course, this is 70 years later. I do see young children, both boys and girls, getting a chance to do a lot of things with recreation programs that were not a big deal when I was a kid. I was involved in a couple of recreation programs, but they were nothing like there are today. Nothing like they were when I was in charge of a recreation area as a parent. And we played, we set up a baseball diamond. We built a baseball diamond behind a school and stuff like that for the kids. So it is. It'd be interesting. I'd like to talk to some kids. Maybe the next time I get to do anything with children, I might ask them about how many of them get to play with their parents on a field or something like that. It would be fun. But I think a lot, even today, I think young kids would be surprised if they knew that their parents did certain activities. So now,
thank
your
you,
turn.
Sash. I really enjoyed that story. And I don't think I'd ever heard that one before.
No, I don't think so.
How long do you think you were at the park with your with the dads?
Oh, I think we were there. Each one of us got, I know I counted at least 20 tries to catch the ball. And it wasn't like, you know, go do it. It was, you know, because when we missed the ball, we had to go and pick it up and all that stuff. And then we got a little bit of a talk about what we were doing. It turns out we weren't, you know, there was all kind of advice. We were doing the approach to seeing the ball was wrong. We weren't comfortable seeing the ball. We were kind of dancing around under it. And that made it difficult to focus on just the ball. And it was a great thing. I think we probably were there for 90 minutes or more.
That's great.
And besides that, because where we went in the park was across the street, right across the street on Eastern Avenue, was Big Eddie's father's little tiny corner store. I went on Eastern and some alley, but it was right on the corner. And they took us over there, got us each a bag of potato chips, and it was not a Coke. What was it? I can't remember the name of that. RC Cola. Royal Crown Cola, which was very popular. And I don't even know if they make that anymore.
I think so.
Yeah. It would be interesting. I should look and see in stores if they make RC Cola. But I remember, and we sat in the park across the street from Eddie's after we got our drinks and our chips. And they had drinks and chips also. And we sat on the hill right across the street in the park and listened to them talk about stuff. They weren't really telling us stories, but they were just talking about stuff. And it was fun.
Well, you ate your chips.
Yep. It was a great day.
Sounds great. You've been listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stosh Ziolkowski.
And our theme today is Stories My Father Told Me.
Okay. And we're going to hear one from Fanny now.
I am. Or yes, you are. This is a story that my dad told me in the late 1990s. He was a storyteller, and I grew up hearing his stories, but he never talked much about his time in the Army, at least not to me. And I knew that he had been in a segregated Black unit for the duration of World War II, and that he had, towards the middle or end of the war, he'd been stationed in Saipan in the Pacific Theater when the U.S. was battling Japan for control of Saipan Island, and then through the Japanese surrender of Saipan. This story is from the beginning of the war, but on Saipan, he took a lot of photographs during his time there, and I have a photo that was taken from a small hilltop, a kind of a rise, of the actual surrender, the Japanese officers signing papers at a table out in the open with troops from both sides in formation at the edge of the scene. And my dad was standing a long, long way off on that rise with this camera. I always wondered if anybody knew that he was up there, if he would have gotten in trouble if they'd known he was taking pictures. I'm guessing he was probably not the only one. But there's hundreds of other photos of the men he worked with, the work they did there. There's some in the mess tents because he was a mess sergeant. There's a lot of vehicle maintenance shots and road crews, Black GIs building a coral bed road with heavy equipment. And then there's a few pictures my dad said he staged of guys playing a game of craps, throwing dice, kneeling in a circle on the dirt floor of a tent. That's one of my favorite pictures. Anyway, my dad was an Army cook and he managed field kitchens as a mess sergeant. When I was growing up, he went on to manage the kitchen at Lankenau Hospital in Philadelphia and then the kitchen for the Methodist Children's Home. And I actually knew kids who were at that home. I met them at summer camp. But at the time that he shared this story, he was 85 or 86 years old, and he'd already been diagnosed with dementia. Some of his stories by that time were a bit rambling and with the occasional shocking ending, but I have no reason to doubt the basics of this story. It was new information for me, but it fit at the time and even now with what I already knew about him. And this is his voice as I remember it. Well, you know, I was active in some progressive left-wing causes, made a bit of a local name for myself in these organizations. So 1942, when I went into the Army, I had some trouble about that. The Colonel McKay, had these notebooks. He showed me these 12 notebooks, official minutes of one of these groups, Third Ward Club from New York City. He said they came from the FBI. That was probably true. He said they were part of the dossier he received when I applied for officer training. He had all this material on me. Now, the company commander called me in. He said, "Who the hell are you?" I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He says, "I don't know. What do I mean? Colonel McKay calls up here to ask what you're doing. How is Private Crawford doing?" I never got that kind of call for anybody else. "Well, he wants to see you. Go on over there." I said, "I don't know why, but I'll let you know." I came back later, told the commander about the notebooks. He says, "Christ, 12 notebooks 12 years. How long were you doing all this? No wonder the colonel's calling. But McKay, the colonel told me, if we could find some other guys with your background, particularly black guys, maybe we could win this war. This guy McKay was a real guy, a real soldier. He understood subtleties of race relations, for one thing. Down there at the training camp in South Carolina, I gathered a group and taught courses in Black history. Macomb County, South Carolina, was where Harriet Tubman freed 1,500 slaves during the Civil War and took them to the Union Army. I lectured on this to the Black troops. It had a profound effect on these guys who had such mixed feelings about the current war. McKay was a white man, but he understood some of this. The colonel knew about people. He knew how to, I was going to say, use people, but it wasn't like that. You didn't feel he was exploiting anyone. He was showing you what you could do. He did that with me when I ran that section, 3 mess halls. Anyway, when the army got hold of you in Spartanburg, South Carolina, when they finished with you there, well, you were in good shape or you were gone. If you didn't make it, you were out. Otherwise, you knew how to handle a rifle and you knew how to survive. The army did me a lot of good, a whole lot of good health-wise. I ate well and I was active, running all the time. Colonel McKay sat me down once and discussed this with me. He said, maybe you should give up your 110 cups of coffee a day. Scale back to 10 cups, though it probably wouldn't make a hell of a lot of difference. He said, you're lucky to be in the mess. You can get that kind of food you need. Most of this is good food. Some mess halls don't have good food, and we're working on that. So if you hear some guys crying about it, you know what to tell them. Some of these guys, some of these cooks, well, McKay was much interested in me as far as being demanding with the cooks. He heard me cuss a guy out. I told the soldier there was some road work going on and he could be out there every day. He could be out there with a shovel or he could shape up and become a good cook. I told him, I think you could be a good cook if you stick with it. McKay had a lot to say. He said, first of all, it's hard to get good cooks, good people. He says, let's work on this together. Don't be afraid to bring me in, not to pressure anybody, just to discuss something you want to do, how it's going to work. And the first thing we took up was the coffee. McKay wanted me in the officer's mess solely for the coffee. The bastards won't get it right, he said. The first lieutenant came in and said, I've been hearing all kinds of things about you. He said, McKay told him, Crawford is a mess sergeant, a real army mess sergeant. You've got a good man with you. There was a corporal named Lancaster. We put him in charge of the coffee. He liked coffee for one thing. And when his mother came to visit, she couldn't believe it that he was doing so well. She just shook her head. He's such a quiet guy, and he's had all kinds of trouble. I said, well, he might have had some trouble here when he first got in, but one thing about your son, he's a tough hombre. He's not going to get tough with anybody lest they get tough with him, but he's strong, very powerful man. Nobody is going to fool with him. I told his mother about the coffee, and then I took her to the mess hall, and she had coffee with us. She was so tickled, you know, that her son had these responsibilities. I guess maybe she figured he would never get a good job because he was so reserved and quiet. He was pretty good with his rifle, too. She said, well, he hunts with his grandfather. He was a farm boy. They sent him out to dig a foxhole, and he dug in. He came in with the shovel. That's it, he said, 8 feet by 8 feet. The officer came in behind him then and said, God damn it, that's 8 feet. That's right, says Lancaster. You said 8 feet, but you went down 8 feet, said the officer. Christ, when we get to battle, you're with me. You can dig the hole damn front. Well, That's what he did, you know. On the farm, he dug holes for fences. The colonel says, trouble with you guys is you never in your life dug a hole before you got here. This guy knows how. After the war, Lancaster got a job near Albany. I don't remember what job, but it was a good one. One of the officers did that for him. He had a couple kids, and his mother went with him there, too. But his first few weeks in the Army, he was in misery. A lot of these young guys, everything was just the opposite of what they were used to. There was no privacy and everything by the book. Some guys, other guys, nothing bothered. They didn't give a damn. This character, Lynch, took a while to get Lynch straightened out. He didn't care about anybody, not the colonel or anybody else. So McKay asked me about Lynch for a particular assignment. I told him. And he said, can he do this? I said, yes, Lynch will do it. He's afraid of nobody, and he's a talented guy. All right, says the colonel, call him in here. You'd better get a bottle, I said. For you? No, for Lynch. Later, McKay told me, I don't know if you realize it, but Lynch was the gem you stumbled on that made it all work. Because when he went out to the railhead where all the supplies came in, there was all this food. Lynch knew everybody, and I couldn't figure out how the hell he knew everybody. But he was running the black market, and we just set him up. You know, he was going out there just hanging around. But when he came out there with me, mess sergeant from Company D, he was official and no one could say anything. He had this whiskey, made a lot of money then. After the war, he opened a funeral parlor in Richmond. It was quite a place, unusually successful and unusually opulent. I went to a political conference there in Virginia, and I stayed with him a few days. That was a time. Now me, I had the most money before I went in the Army from doing pretty well back in New York, in Olean. I had a bank account when I went into the Army. I don't remember how big, but I remember Colonel McKay saw that bank book and told me, that's too much, send it home. There are people here who can do anything. They can't win the goddamn war, but they can figure out how to get that money, get rid of it to a safer place. So what are your questions, Stosh? I knew that you were going to say, but in the Army, and then you were going to ask me questions.
Oh, no, I cannot possibly... question anything about soldiers in the Second World War, especially not about the black troops. You and I have discussed some of this before, but you know, I was a bit ignorant about things that had happened in our country when I was a kid. I was truly mostly into my own world, and I did not realize when I was a young person just how bad slavery affected people and that. Because in my school, I never heard the word slavery. I went to a Catholic elementary school for 9 years, kindergarten to eighth grade, and I absolutely never heard a single word about black people. Except if I heard somebody say something about a black person and I didn't understand half the time what they were talking about, because there were no black people in my neighborhood. There were no black children in my school. There were never any black children in any schools I attended. All the way up until my senior year of college, that was the first time that I ever was in the same school building with a black person. And of course, he was a great basketball player who wound up being in the pros. And he was the first Black person to attend Mount St. Mary's and stay in the dorms. Some people nowadays talk about him being the first Black person to go to Mount St. Mary's College, but that's not true, because John Williams was the first Black student to attend Mount St. Mary's, and he attended there because his grandfather waited on the dinner table for the priests, and he was allowed to take classes at the Mount, and he graduated from the Mount, I believe, but he was not allowed to stay in the dorms. He had to live off campus. So anyway, also, when I was in the Army, I'm sure that things were different, because your father was in the Army during a time when Black troops were segregated completely. There was no mixing between the Black and white troops as far as in a company or something like that. But when I went in 1959, there were quite a few Black soldiers, Black young men who joined the Army at the same time I did. I would guess that in the company I was in our platoon, our company had about 220, I think it's 221 soldiers. And in our platoon, we had, I think, 46 or 47 guys that lived in our barracks, who were all in this same platoon. And there were, I would say, close to half of those soldiers were Black. And that was the first time I got to know young Black men, and could sit and talk to them, stuff like that. I never did that when I was at home. And there was no opportunity to do that. And it would never have dawned on me to go to another neighborhood and to meet a Black person. So I would have a hard time trying to understand or ask any questions about the soldiers' behavior then, because the only thing I ever learned about the Second World War, and I was shocked when I first found it out, that men could be sent to war to support our country in their efforts against bad people, or supposedly, you know, and that they had to be separated from the other soldiers. The Black soldiers had to be separate from the other soldiers. And then it turned out that I did learn that there were some Black units that had white officers, that they had white soldiers in charge of Black soldiers, but they were not white soldiers mixed in with the Black soldiers. So I don't know if I said that properly, but I'm glad they don't do that anymore, because it doesn't make sense. It didn't make sense to me then. It doesn't make sense to me now that they ever did it. But the older I get, the more I'm learning, which is true. You know, it's just recently, my wife and I were talking, and I said, sometimes when people talk about history and all this stuff, I don't think people realize that we only, as human beings on this planet, we don't have a history that's a million years old. They can talk all they want about people, you know, may have lived in so-and-so, this part of Africa or that part of someplace 50,000 years ago, but they're not talking about us. They're talking about people who were our ancestors along the line in evolution. And they weren't walking around in clothes, and they weren't going to the store or building homes and stuff like that. They were living in caves or shelters and things. And our history as humans, in the sense that we have families and we have political groups and stuff like that, even on a very simple basis, can't be more than about 12 or 13,000 years old. And so as humans and as a human species and a population, we are very young as creatures. We don't have a long, long, long history. And when, in my opinion, when I observe the way we behave, I think we have a lot to learn before we get to be what we should be. You know, we have a lot of crazy rules that humans have, you know, and the one word that I have learned to dislike, although it's used so much, is, and it's not meant to be a bad word, but the word other. There are so many cases of how one group dislikes the others because they're different in some way. And for me, the stupidest thing is because their skin color is different, or because they speak a different language, or because they think differently about a God, you know, different religion, something like that. And as a kid, I was taught that I truly was taught that the Jewish people were bad people because they killed Jesus and stuff. I can't even imagine anyone telling a child that. But when I was old enough and had enough sense to realize that Jesus was a Jew, and that he had nothing to do with trying to cause trouble and all that, it just boggled my mind that there were the women in black, the nuns, who talked openly about the Jewish people being bad people. And I'm sure that, I guess that was some part of their upbringing or something like that. But, you know, the more I think about it, how awful to teach a five-year-old or a six-year-old that some people are bad, and to tell them that and be wrong about it. It's bad enough to tell them things that are bad or put down people, but to say things about a person and blame them for something that they weren't guilty of. That's my sermon for today.
Wow.
I'm sorry.
You're listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. That was Star Stilkowski, and I am
Fandy Crawford.
Thought I'd throw you for a loop.
Thought there for a minute you caught something from me and forgot who you were.
No, I wondered if you forgot. Okay.
I do have a story about the Second World War.
Okay.
Okay.
It's time to
and
tell.
This it. Is okay. This is a story my father told me. This story has two parts. One is when that my father told me part of it. And then there's a second part of it that my father wasn't involved in at all. Okay. I was a teenager when my father and I were, I don't know where, we were going someplace in the car. I think we were going to see my uncle, who was a priest. My dad used to do things for him, help him out with different kind of projects he was doing. And my father was talking about the subject of Second World War came up, and he began telling me about his youngest brother who died in the war. And he said, I don't think your brothers know this. I don't think I've ever told anybody, any of the children in the family is. Said, but during the war, all three of my brothers were in the service. Uncle Jewel, Uncle Frank, and one of my sisters, actually, Aunt Martha, and Uncle Ludwig. We call them Ludwig in the house, but he was, Uncle Ludwig was a twin. He and his twin were born in the 20s. And unfortunately, his twin did not survive. Shortly after they were both born, the other twin became ill and passed away. And so Dad said he always felt bad for Uncle Lou because he knew he had a twin brother, but he never got to know him because he died as a child. And anyway, Dad told me that there was a night when he had a dream. He woke up sweating and disturbed. He said it was during the war. He got out of bed and went downstairs to the kitchen, just sat at the table thinking about his dream. And he said it really disturbed him. I wanted to ask him questions, but he seemed like he was just almost like he was just talking, not necessarily even to me. He wanted to say these words. And he said, "I had this dream where my brother Ludwig appeared to me. He was in uniform. And he said, 'Paul, take care of Mom. I won't be coming home.' And when I woke up, it was terrible because it sounded so real. And my father told me that, he said, that very day I decided after work I was going to go and to see my mother. So we went over to my grandmother, at the time was living with Aunt Betty, her youngest daughter. And my father went over after work and stopped by and just, he made a, you know, in his mind, he told me I made up a story. I just was at work and thought I should stop by and see Mom, say hi. And when he got into the Aunt Betty's house, it was strange because the house was so quiet. And he called, "Hello, hello." And finally, Aunt Betty came out and said, "Mom's in her bedroom. She's lying down. I told her I thought it was you that was downstairs, and she said to ask you to come up." I said, "She all right?" She'll tell you what's wrong." And they told me my sister Betty, she was crying and upset. I thought Mom was sick. I climbed the steps and Mom was propped up in bed. She had heard my voice. And she said, "I got this today from the War Department or somebody." She was holding an official looking thing in her hand. I think it was a telegram, but she said, "Ludwig will not be coming home. He's dead." And my dad was a very big, strong man. And he told me, he said, when my mother said those words, I dropped to my knees next to her bed and just laid my head down. And she told me what the words were on that telegram or that paper. And he said, "I'm not too proud to say, I cried like a baby over my little brother." Well, Uncle Lou never did come home. he was buried somewhere in Europe in a military cemetery. But after the war, there were a number of soldiers whose caskets were uninterred and sent home. I don't know if the families had to pay for that or how it was done or why it was done, because a lot of men are still buried, men and women in the service that died during the war are still buried in other places. But Uncle Lou did get to be buried in the cemetery in Baltimore. There was a cemetery for war victims of the war. And I didn't know very much about Uncle Lou because Dad never said much else about him. But and I really didn't know what to ask. I would like to have known, but anyway, if we can sort of fast forward into the mid 70s, actually closer to the late 70s, my father had passed away in 1973. And I hadn't thought anything about my dad's story about his brother and dying in the war and his dream. And it came, a time came when I had a Volkswagen van that I had run into the ground. It was a used car that I bought, and I had, you know, really run it down, and it was dead and was parked in my yard. A man stopped by and said, "Is that van for sale?" And I said, "Yeah, but it's not worth much." And he said, "Yeah, I know. He said, I figured that. I passed there along this road a lot, and I keep seeing it, and it's always in that corner. Would you like to sell it?" And I said, "Sure, I'd like to get rid of it, but it doesn't even run." He said, "Well, I work for a man who buys cars like that, and he can probably use the parts. So do you mind if I take a look at it?" "No, no, go ahead." And he looked at it and everything. He said, "There's a lot of good things on this, still on this van." He said, "I'm going to talk to my boss and see, maybe, you know." He said, "Well, how much would you like for it?" I said, "You know, I have no idea what the parts might be worth, but I tell you the truth, if I tell my wife that you're interested in this, she'll say give it to him because she's tired of looking at it. She thought it was a piece of junk." But anyway, okay, so a couple of days later, I get a call, and this guy says, "I told my boss about the van, and he said he would give you $400 for it." And I thought, whoa, I thought he was going to say $100 or something. That's fine with me. Come and get it. So the guy did. The next day, he showed up. He towed it. You know, he had arrangements and hooked some kind of a chain on the thing and towed the van away. And gave me a card with his boss's name on it and address, and it was not that far. It was only over on Route 30, and it was about 10, 12 miles away. So anyway, and he said, the boss said, "If you could come by Saturday, he'll give you a check." I said, "Okay." So on Saturday, I went over there, and when I walked into the place, I looked and I said, "Hi, are you Mr. Fahrenholt?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "Well, your man came and got my van and said you're going to give me $400 for it." And he said, and I said, "Yeah." He said, "There's a lot of stuff on it I can use." He said, "I'll put that in the back, and I do a lot of work on Volkswagen, so I can use parts and that." And he said, "Who should I make the check out to?" And I told him my name, and he looked. He said, "How do you spell that?" And I spelled it for him. He said, "That's interesting." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, I was in World War II with a soldier. I was with him the day he was killed, and we had gone into the military about the same time. He was a young guy from Baltimore, and that was his last name." And I said, "What was his first name?" He said, "It was an old-fashioned name. His name was Ludwig." And I said, "You know what? That was an uncle of mine." Anyway, he told me a story. He said, "Before we shipped out, we had a couple of days pass, and your uncle, we called him Luds. Your uncle Luds and myself and another guy, Luds invited us to come down to his place in Baltimore because there was going to be," he said, "my memory's not so good. I don't know if it was a reception after a wedding or if it was a family party, but he said there was a whole bunch of people and they had a picnic in the backyard, and boy, we had a great time. They treated us like, they treated us just like we were Luds's, buddies. And they treated us so well. We danced with some of the young women and everybody made us feel at home and we had a great time. And Luds and I talked about that party a number of times once we got to Europe. And especially if there were bad days, we sometimes were reminiscing about that last great party we had attended and looked forward to doing it again when we got back home. Unfortunately, he didn't make it." Well, I asked the man then, I said, "This is interesting because I was going to ask you about your name." He said, "Why?" I said, do you have a son named Joe?" He said, "Yeah." Well, he was just a kid. He's a senior in high school. I said, "Yeah. And I think I know him." And he said, "Really?" I said, "Yeah, I'm a track coach. And I have seen your son run. He is a great runner." He said, "Oh, that's nice to hear. And I know he's a great runner. I try to go to his track meets. And I sometimes get there, not often. But anyway, it was nice to, reminisce with him." And I asked him, I said, "Do you mind if I would tell my uncles? My father has passed away, but my two uncles are still alive. And I'm sure they would like to know, maybe have a chance to talk to you about Uncle Lou. And maybe you even met them, but I don't know if you would have or not, because they were in the war. And I think they were probably in right from the beginning." He gave me permission to tell them name, number, everything. And I'd be glad to talk to them. So I did. I called my uncles and gave them both of them the information. And they told me they would look him up. I don't know if they ever did, really. I think they did, but I'm really not sure, because I wasn't living near Baltimore at the time. I was in Westminster, and a few years after that, actually, I was attending my Uncle Frankie's funeral, and I spoke to his daughter, and I asked her, did your dad ever do anything with that information I gave about his brother who was killed in the war? And she said, "Yeah, Dad did. See, he talked to the man on phone, and they talked about getting together. I don't think they ever did really actually get together, but he talked to him on the phone a number of times, and he seemed very pleased because he didn't know who the man was, hadn't met him. He was not at the party that the man talked about, but it was good to hear some things about his brother." And it was interesting. I wish my dad had been alive when I sold that Volkswagen to Mr. Fahrenholt, because I know my dad would love to have talked to him and about his younger brother.
Wow. What a great story, Stosh. Phew, it's got everything. It's a war story. It's got family. It's got neighborhood and finding lost memories. really good. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you. Thanks. I appreciate it. I've never told that to anybody.
It's a good one. You should tell her. Yeah.
Maybe I will. Well, you know this, what?
We're out of time.
I know.
This is Fanny Crawford.
And Stasz Ziolkowski.
Your co-hosts for the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. We're independent community radio broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, Martinsburg, West Virginia, and Hagerstown, Maryland. We are offering you, our listeners, a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging you to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for
The John Blues. We have left the clear glass of smooth jazz, and we're into the blues and roots today. So,
all right.